I think this is going to be the official theme tune of Caldi. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about how to run Caldi. So basically, we'll be going. We have two recipes that come with our stuff. One is resource management, and one's Wall Street Journal. We're going to go through some of the resource management recipe, and we'll have a few digressions to explain as much of the internals of Caldi as you need to know to kind of vaguely understand it. We'll go through the installation process. I'll describe the Unix one because that's what most people will use, but it also has a Visual Studio Windows one. The scripts, our scripts are all in Bash, again, for popularity reasons. Caldi is kind of agnostic about the shell. There's nothing in it that's really specific to any one shell. Now, suppose you want to download Caldi and you want to run it. You would probably first go to this location, caldi.sourceforge.net. SF will also work. We have a page there with documentation that explains pretty much everything Caldi related. We use a source control program called Subversion. The command name is SVN. It'll typically be installed on most of the systems you will have. SVN is a little bit like CVS, but it's a more modern implementation. So to check out Caldi, you would just type this command. And this will, you'll see a lot of stuff go by on the screen. It will check out a bunch of directories, the code, the scripts, the installation instructions, the documentation source, and so on. The installation instructions, you'll just look at the install file. And the installation is pretty simple. It's like change directory to here, run install.sh, cd to here, run configure, run make. There is a rather non-zero probability that something will go wrong because it does kind of hope that certain things are installed. But we kind of provide instructions to fix the common cases. And if it doesn't install, please ask me and I'll try to help you to get it to install. There is a directory of kind of external tools, and we try to have a script to configure and to download and make all of these external tools so that you don't have to worry about that yourself. These include SPH to pipe to decode sphere files. IRSTLM is a language modeling toolkit. As I mentioned before, we chose this because it has a relatively open license. It's very limited features. OpenFST, etc. So suppose you've done that, you've checked it out, you've tried to install it. Scratch that sentence. So in the future, we're going to have version numbers and everything. Currently, because we haven't yet come to version 1.0, we just have trunk, which is the kind of version control thing for whatever your current code is. Inside there, you'll find tools, which is a place where we're going to download and compile various external tools. You'll find SRC, source, which is where all of our source code is, including the source for our documentation. And these are the subdirectories in there. These are the names of the things that I showed you on that funny slide with the rectangles. So this is all the subdirectories of code. And EGs is a directory of scripts that contains the resource management and Wall Street Journal scripts. You can probably see a certain hubris in the naming scheme here. We went for a very deep naming scheme because we believe that eventually there'll be tons of scripts in those directories. So suppose you've done the installation in tools, and that's really just running a script normally. You go to source, do configure. The configure scripts, sometimes configure scripts are these vast scripts that are auto-generated by things like automake or whatever it is. But this one is just a hand-generated one. It tries to find where your like Atlas library or CLAPAC library is. And if it finds it, then it compiles it with that. And it detects certain systems like Cygwin and macOS that have particular setups that are common, and then it handles those separately. It's good to type -j4 when you make the code because there's a lot of tools and the code is rather templated, so the compilation is a little bit slow. This makes it in parallel. If you type make test, it goes to all the subdirectories and runs all the programs that end with -test. We have a lot of testing programs. They're mostly unit tests to make sure that all of the code is working. Things like you have a matrix multiplication or something, you do the multiplication and you verify that the answer is right, things like that. And there's also, if you can also type make valgrind, and it runs a program called valgrind to check for memory errors. And that would, I mean, right now there's no errors, but that would detect if there were things like unallocated memory. So suppose you've done that. You've typed make test, and nothing went wrong. So you cd to EG's RMS1, and this is where our example scripts are. This assumes that you know, you're a member of the LDC or whatever, and you have access to these things. You'd obtain this corpus. I think for members it's like $300, but a lot of sites will have it already. This is the resource management corpus. It's a really old, really simple corpus, but we use it because it's really fast to run, and it's because it's kind of an LVCSR-like task. It's really medium vocabulary, but because it contains actual words and it has a lexicon and everything, it kind of behaves like a typical LVCSR system, even though it's very small. So this will be on some directory, and you have to figure out what that directory is. At some point, you'll have to pass it to one of the scripts. There's a bunch of commands in here that you're supposed to run. You're not really expected to run this directly. It will just exit on you if you do that. It's just a sequence of commands that you're expected to run by hand, because there's a high enough probability that any given one of them will fail that you felt it wasn't good to be over-optimistic and just make it a single script. I mean, the failures are going to be due to simple things like you gave it the wrong directory or something, but anyway. So I'm going to go through what this run.sh does. The first thing is data preparation. And so you'll see there's a directory called data prep. You cd to there. You know what the directory of your resource management data is. This is the LDC disk. You give it that path, and it'll just do a bunch of stuff. Basically, it's converting whatever format this corpus has into a format that Kaldi likes. And, you know, accumulating lists of file names, things like that. And you cd up. Just for things that are created by this step, there's a bunch of stuff actually in this directory that it creates. Here's an example SCP file. So it contains the utterance ID, and then this is a pipe command. From here to here is a pipe command. So this command is going to be run whenever some program tries to read this. Now, an SCP file, this is a concept that our toolkit has. It's not really quite the same as HDK's notion of an SCP file. And I'll be explaining later exactly what that is. Another thing that's created here is a decoding graph in FST format. In some other scripts, like in the Wall Street Journal script, this stage wouldn't be creating any FSTs. It would just create an ARPA. But because RM doesn't use an ARPA, we do it like this. So another stage of data preparation. This is created in that directory too. It comes from stuff that's in the resource management disk. It'll create a lexicon for you in this format, which is pretty obvious. And we'll later turn it into an FST. The Kaldi tools don't really deal with this directly. They deal with FST. So the lexicon that you give to Kaldi is just going to be an open FST format FST. There are also some utterance to speaker maps. So this is utterance ID. This is speaker ID. It's a file that contains a lot of these. This is how Kaldi, you know, maps utterances to speakers and vice versa. There's no notion of like masks or file names or anything. So this concept of utterance ID is quite important in Kaldi. There's no notion of like parsing file names and saying like the last element is the utterance ID or whatever. You have to have an explicit list. And all of these SCP files and archives are indexed by this utterance ID that you have to decide on. That script also creates a text format of the transcriptions, but we'll convert this into an integer format that Kaldi likes, just so that Kaldi doesn't need to have, for all of the programs, some kind of map between the text and integer form of the words. So this is the text format of the transcriptions. Next step after that data prep stuff, we prepare the graphs. There's going to be a bunch of OpenFST commands in here, like scripts to convert from the lexicon to the FSD format. The lexicon actually contains the silence and the script. The script kind of adds it in. It's not something that's very deeply embedded in Kali. These little files, if you've ever used the AT&T toolkit or OpenFST, you'll know what these are. They're symbol tables. So it says that this is the text form of 0, this is the text form of 1, etc. And EPS for epsilon is always 0. This is kind of a common thing in FST toolkits. It knows that that ID is 0. So this is why phones are 1-based, because 0 is always reserved for epsilon. It creates, all of the, so OpenFST does have a capability to put symbol tables on the FST, so the FSTs would kind of know what the words were. But we haven't used that because it quickly becomes very difficult once you decide to have symbol tables on the FSTs. We basically use integer formats throughout after the data preparation stages. It outputs these files. This is the G, the grammar, that could be an ARPA language model. This is used for decoding. This is the lexicon. L underscore disambig is a lexicon of disambiguation symbols. And if anyone has read the papers of Mori et al. That describe their standard recipe for FST-based ASR, you'll know what that is. Little symbols like #1, #2, that they put on the lexicon at the ends of words to ensure determinizability. I'd better not go into that in more detail, or it's going to suck up the entire time of the talk. Preparing integer lists of silence and non-silence phones. We create these little files that contain things like this. These are needed later on by the scripts, because occasionally a script will need to know what the IDs of the silence phones are. And because the Kali tools deal with the integer formats, it's going to need that as a list of integers. Computing raw. Okay, so this is just a command to invoke a kind of other script that computes the MFCCs. And here is the command line. I believe I showed you this before. It basically writes the MFCCs to some disk. And then this is going to be a text file that contains, on each line is going to be utterance ID, and then this file name, colon, integer offset. So it can kind of directly go to that part of the file using fseek. Okay, I think this is what I just said. This is the script format that I mentioned. Of course, the script format is very generic. This whole thing, it doesn't have to be of this form. It's any one of our extended file names that might include a real file, something of this form, a pipe, whatever. I'm showing you what the archive format looks like, but really it's binary data, so there's not a lot that you can see. but in some cases, it would be text. I mean, you can give it the option to write in text, and very often it'll be a nice line-by-line format. Yeah. So I think I mentioned this before. The script, this key is an important concept, because there's this concept of a collection of objects indexed by a key, and this key is a string. Think of it a little bit like an STL map, where, you know, it'd be a map from string to whatever object. So the archives and the script both kind of make use of this concept. And I'll explain that concept in a little bit more detail in the next slide. But the script format is the key, and then some kind of extended file name, blah, blah, blah. I think I mentioned this before, but the types of extended file names include an actual file, a command piping output, pipe symbol, then a command, which is like for the which is the input version. No, that's the output version. This is when you're outputting to a pipe. This is where you're inputting from a pipe. And an offset into a file, which is useful where you want to write a big archive but have random access into it. So this might seem like a very, very minor thing, but I think it's important to, if you actually want to ever use Kali, to understand this, how this works. So there's a concept of a table. And this table doesn't really correspond to any like concrete object or class. It's a more generic concept. The idea is a collection of objects of some known type, a type known in advance, all indexed by a key, which is a string. We define a key as a non-empty space-free string, for instance, that. And obviously, we have to make it space-free, so otherwise we get into all kinds of issues with escaping and so on. So there are three templated classes that somehow relate to tables. There's a table writer, sequential table reader, and random access table reader. So there's two ways. There's three ways you can do something with a table. You can write a table, and what you do with this is you'd say, write me something with this key and this object, and it's going to write it to the table. And you need to keep doing that. You can read a table sequentially, which means repeatedly, give me the next key and give me the next object. Or you can do random access on a table, which means, do you have an object of this key, yes or no? If so, give me the object. That's how you interact. Now, these are templates. They're templated on, I'm going to describe in the next slide what they're templated on. They're not actually templated on the object itself. It would be most natural to template on the object that's in the table. But the problem is that doesn't work very well with kind of fundamental types like integers and so on. Because the normal Caldy objects, they have a read function and a write function that have a particular behavior that's common to all of them. But we can't just assume that everything we want to read and write will have that format. Because how would we write integers, or how would we write STL vectors, or whatever? And it would be ridiculous, in my opinion, to somehow have to derive a class that's an integer, you know, and give it extra things, because an integer is not a class in C++. So we template on what we call a holder. A holder class is a class that has certain read and write functions, and it has a type def T inside it that is the actual type that the table holds. So, you know, knowing all of this stuff is, if you, I lost you by now because you're not a C++ guru, it really doesn't matter. Because this is, I'm just explaining how the internals of this mechanism works, but you don't need to know this to understand how the whole thing works. So I think this is an example of how, at the C++ level, you use the table concept. So we're introducing some terminology here that may seem a bit annoying, but eventually becomes clarifying. An R specifier is a string that tells the table code how to read a table object. And here's an example of one. ARK colon this file name. So the table code is going to parse this. And when it reads this, it says, OK, you're telling me that this is an archive. It's something that has the key object in it. And this is an extended file name that tells you how to open a pipe of some kind or open a stream. So now this is a type name, sequential table reader templated on this holder type. So this is basically we're reading something of type int32. So this is the object name. In the initializer, we're giving it this string. So as soon as you initialize the object, it's opening the pipe. It's saying we're going to read from this thing. So now we're using this object. We're saying what for blah 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 blah. What this code is doing is it's getting each key in turn from the sequential table reader. And of course, since this is a sequential table reader, that's what this object expects us to do. So the point is that there may be errors, right? Some of the objects may not be there. Sometimes, you know, something may go wrong. The templated code is going to handle that, so your kind of user-level code just sees it as a sequential access to something. I think this covers stuff that I've already told you. There are some things that the table code has to do that are a little bit tricky. One of these things is very often you want to do random access on objects that are in an archive, and that archive may be in a pipe, because we use a lot of pipes. And the problem is that suppose for some reason you query a key that was not in the archive. In order to tell you no, it wasn't in the archive, it's going to have to read each one in the archive, go to the end of the pipe, and then say no. But that means that, now it doesn't know that you're not going to ask for something else later, so it's got to store all of that stuff in memory. So in order to stop it from having to do this, you can specify in the R specifier thing a little comma S, comma CS, little options that will tell it this archive is sorted on key, or we're going to call this archive in sorted order. So basically, that gives the code enough information to know that it doesn't have to store all this stuff in memory, and it can still kind of be correct. I'm going to go a little bit faster through this now. I think we went through this, computing MFCCs. Monophone training. So you would invoke this script. We're going to go through the script a little bit. It sets up some variables in Bash, the directory where you're doing your experiment. The features, I think we saw one of these strings before. This is an R specifier that I mentioned before. This part tells it that we're going to interpret this stream as an archive. This tells it how to open the stream. And of course, this is a pipe. It's another Kali command that has its own things. Sometimes these things can even be nested, but beyond one level of nesting, the shell escaping would become too painful. So
we don't. This means a pipe.
Well, so in fact, this is an output. There's always outputs on the right. So what this is, it's adding deltas. It's reading in this script file that says where the features are. And it's outputting to an archive on the standard output. So, and then this says that this whole thing is a pipe. So this part gets interpreted by the program that is given this. You'll get used to it. So in the, just going through the monophone training script, we create a file called exp/mono/topo that specifies the HMM topology to Kaldi. So, I mean, you can. This file is fairly self-explanatory. A script creates this. You see, these are the three states, and then this is a kind of final state that Kaldi knows that the last state always has an exit probability of one. This is the command to initialize the GMM. Initialize it with a dimension of 39, outputs to here. And this also outputs a tree, a very trivial tree that doesn't really have any splits in it. And that's how we handle a monophone system. Even a monophone system has a decision tree. It's just so that you don't have, you know, all the code is unified. Let me see if we have anything else here. Okay. Creating decoding graphs for training. All of the kind of training scripts have a command of this form that it creates an archive that has all of the FSTs, one for each utterance. And we do this as a separate command because otherwise it would be too slow. We don't want to do it on each iteration. It's a little bit too slow. So it takes the tree, the initial model, the lexicon FST, this is the transcriptions in integer format. And the output goes to this pipe that it just gzips it and puts it in that file. So this is just the format of the .trat.traf file. It's just an integerized transcription where we've converted all of the strings to their integer numbers. Not a lot of people like that. Okay, so the very first stage of monophone training is a flat start where you kind of divide the utterance equally according to the number of phones or whatever and create an alignment that corresponds to that. So the output of this program is something called an alignment, which is basically for each utterance, it's a vector of integers. And each of those integers is an ID that I touched on earlier. We call it a transition ID. It's something that behaves roughly similar to a PDF index or PDF ID, but it has a little bit more information so you know the phone and you know what the transition was. So it kind of contains sufficient information to update everything. So we pipe that into this program, gmmacstats.ali. The suffix ali means that it reads in alignments because there are different versions of this program that read in alignments, that read in posteriors, Gaussian level posteriors and different things. So it takes the model, it takes the features. This is a shell variable. This gets expanded to a string. It reads in this stuff from the input, the standard input. and it outputs to this file. So, by the way, whenever something has ARC on it or has SCP on it, that's an R specifier or W specifier. That means that there's a collection of objects being passed around, indexed by key. But if you don't see that, like here, then it's just a file. It's just a single stream. There's no notion of indexing. I think I covered this. Oh, yeah, and this is the GMM update. So it takes the original model, the accumulator, outputs the new model. So this is the Viterbi stage of training. What we do during training is on selected iterations, we redo the alignments. And we don't necessarily do that every iteration simply because this is the thing that takes most of the time. And of course, if you have multiple Gaussians, this is not the only thing that's going on in training, so it makes sense to not do it every time. So I think this is pretty obvious. There should be two dashes here. You give it the beam, give it the model. This is a stream that has all the FSTs on it, the features, and that's an option. I mentioned briefly options on these R specifiers, or in this case, a W specifier. It tells it to write in text format. This is text. The default is binary, but you could do comma B if you wanted to emphasize it. In monophone training, we realign on almost every iteration because I think I found that was better or something. Or maybe it's because you usually have single Gaussians. I think after your system has stabilized a bit, you don't have to realign so often. So typically during a kind of epoch of triphone training, we'd only realign 3 or 4 times. To mix up, to increase the number of Gaussians, this may be slightly against the whole Kaldi philosophy, but it's just an option to the update program. The way we allocate Gaussians, we don't have a constant number of Gaussians per state. We provide, it's a power law. It's proportional to the count. And this shouldn't be 0.5. This should be 0.2. I don't know why that's that way. It's just slightly better than having a constant number. So the actual schedule we use to allocate the Gaussians is typically you start from a certain number, you linearly increase, and then it levels out. It would probably be more natural to increase with a log, kind of increase with a power law or something, but it just didn't work as well. It was better to do it linearly. Okay, so triphone training. The first stage is we align all of the data that we... For the monophone, we use a subset because it's just no point to use all of it for such a small system. So we realign all of the data and we output alignments. We accumulate a special kind of stats for training the decision tree. What this is, for each unique triphone context in this case, it's going to accumulate a single Gaussian, well, the stats for a single Gaussian, and this is going to enable us to train the tree in the standard way. So there's a bunch of stuff in the script that kind of automatically does some automatic clustering and produces questions. We don't use hand-generated questions just because it's a hassle to find them. And there's basically these are producing various files that will be read by Kaldi. So a lot of the actual control of how the tree gets set up is done at the script level. So building the tree, this is a Kaldi command that builds a tree. What this actually does is it goes up to 1,500 leaves. And then it kind of clusters it back down a little bit, but by an unpredictable amount because the actual threshold it uses to do the clustering after the initial splitting is the same as the kind of last successful split. So you can't quite predict how big it'll be, but normally it shrinks by 20% versus what you asked it to give you. So you initialize the model for this tree. This program doesn't know if it's going to be a GMM or a full covariance GMM or SGMM that you're going to create. So it's a separate program to initialize the model. This is a nice feature of the whole alignment concept, that you can actually take an alignment produced for one model and convert it to kind of be valid for another model. So that means that you can avoid a certain amount of regenerating alignments. Okay, so if you want to decode, you have to build a decoding graph. This is how we invoke the graph generation script. And the things that it's doing, first it composes L with G, determinizes, minimizes, you get LG. There's some silly stuff with disambiguation symbols going on. I'm not going to go through that. Then you have to compose C as the context FST. It kind of expands the phones into context-dependent phones. And there's some kind of dynamic generation of the context FST going on that happens within memory inside here. I'm not going to go in more detail what's going on here. And then this last one, make H transducer. There's this H FST that it basically expands out the HMMs. So on the right are the context-dependent phones. On the left, you've got the PDFs, but it adds all the self-loops and everything. So this is creating an FST that does that. And the last stage is to compose H with CLG. Determinize, minimize is the answer. Oh, and we did that without self-loop. So at the end, this is to just make these more memory efficient. We wait till the very end to add the self-loops. So this just goes briefly through the decoding script. We create a shell variable that tells it what the features will be. Then we invoke this program. There's three decoders, and this would affect the command name. It could be GMM decode simple, faster, or CALDI. This is the kind of medium one. The GMM decode simple is mainly there for debugging, because it's so simple that, you know, there can't be anything wrong with it. So we just compare that. So decoding beam is 20. This is a beam in kind of language model scale. We only scale the acoustics, not the language model. This is just so you can get more human readable output. This is the model. This is the FST features. This isn't a W specifier. It specifies how to write the transcriptions. It says do it in text format. But these are still going to be integers. We're going to have to change them to text before scoring if we want the text format. And this is the alignment. This isn't really useful if you're just decoding, but you might want to do adaptation later using that decoding pass as the supervision. So it's just kind of, we just always produce it because it doesn't cost anything. Okay, so I think this basically comes to the end of this talk. I've given you a very vague idea of how the scripts work, what's in them. Obviously, there's a lot more details that you'd want to find out before using them, but a lot of that stuff is in the documentation. You have to kind of dig around the documentation. I've been told that it's not very clear where to start, but there is a lot of it there, so if you're just willing to read it all. also, it's heavily cross-referenced. So if you find something that's kind of related to what you need, there'll usually be a link that you can click on that will take you to what you do need. Okay, so that's it. So any questions? CALDI never really deals directly with any of those symbols because it's all in integers. So it really doesn't matter as far as CALDI is concerned what it is. So yeah, I assume that you could do it in UTF-8.
How about your keys and extended?
Well, those have to contain no white space and be non-empty. So I don't. Yeah, it's not going to worry about UTF-8 as long as it's not white space. I think it never checks that it's actually ASCII. But I mean, I think UTF-8 is such that if it's not, that it's never going to be white space because it's always more than 128 or something. I don't know. But it should be UTF-8 friendly. However, I don't really think it's a good idea to put UTF-8 in those things because, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm old fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it should work, but you've got to be concerned about this shell, though, because it could be that the shell is doing some kind of manipulation on the lines of that file, and if you've got weird characters in, I don't know whether, let's say, Perl would, you know, buff or something. But it should be easily changeable to handle that if it really becomes an issue. Uh-huh. I believe it can. I think I originally wrote it so that it could, but I don't recall it. I don't think it's ever been tested, but it's just a Perl script, so it's super simple. Well, the format that I showed didn't have those probabilities, but I think the Perl script that creates the lexicon actually has a flag that is supposed to accept them, or at least it did at one point, but it's never been tested, but it's just a, you know, 30-line Perl script, so it's not like... Yeah, yeah. So Kali doesn't really care whether the lexicon has probabilities. It's just an FST. So, yeah. Yeah. So. Well, they can get very large. I mean, we've decoded with ones that were like 1.5 gig, I think. I think that was with a somewhat pruned trigram LM. They do get very big, but at some point we're going to create decoders that don't suffer from that problem. I mean, I think the FST formalism, it's great because it's easy to debug and it's simple, but you know, maybe the memory usage isn't the best it could be. We're going to work on it. So if there's no more questions, I guess we can call it a day. Oh, one more. I guess we can put it there.
Why there is no music in
there? Oh, you have to redo the music. Down, 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 down.
How about the